does anything that we do really matter? I guess it's a question we've all asked at various points. And it's an important question, I think, not just to protect us from midlife crises and existential angst in the middle of the night, but it's actually a very practical question. I think it's a question that can impact us every day. Why am I doing what I'm doing? Why am I getting out of bed? Would it make any difference if I slacked off and coasted? And this fear we have of a meaningless life is actually a very significant fear, I think, for our society at the moment. It's one of the things, isn't it, which drives this frantic quest for fame and recognition. So many billions of people on this planet. How can I show that I'm special, that I matter? And this same fear drives many people with an obsession in their, especially in their work, to try and make a mark, do something which makes a difference so that we can be known and hopefully remembered. Now, that's an obvious concern for us. It's obviously going to be a worry for us if we're being fed the worldview all around us, which is that all we are is biological survival machines stuck on an insignificant rock hurtling through a meaningless universe towards extinction. Of course, if that's what we think, we're going to be haunted by this question, because that worldview tells us that what we do cannot matter ultimately. But even as Christians, I think it's easy to buy into a sort of fatalistic view of God and his sovereignty, where basically God has planned everything out. He's definitely going to achieve all his purposes, whatever we do, independently of us. And therefore, what difference really is my little life going to make in the grand scheme of things? And last week, we started working through this lovely little book of Ruth in the Old Testament together. And I mentioned last week that one of the main messages of this book is how the Lord is at work, not just in the miraculous, not just in those big dramatic moments, but also in the ordinary and in the mundane. And today we're going to see that it's not simply that he is at work in these moments, but wonderfully God chooses to advance his purposes in this world through ordinary believers doing ordinary acts, or sometimes extraordinary acts of kindness. So we are going to hit this topic in a bit, but first I'm going to begin and we're going to read through the story together, and we're going to see something wonderful, first of all, about the Lord's kindness. We're actually going to spend the bulk of our time on this first point there on the screens. The Lord welcomes the outsider who takes refuge under his wing. So let's pick up the story. I'll give a little recap. Last week we were introduced to Naomi. She's an Israelite woman who emigrated to Moab, and she ended up losing her husband there. And then after that, her sons married, and she lost both her sons. And she's ended up heading back the 30 or so miles back to her home in Bethlehem in Israel. And one of her daughters-in-law, we saw last week, a Moabite called Ruth, has courageously decided to pledge herself to Naomi and to Naomi's God, and she's returned to Bethlehem with Naomi. So that's where we've got to. And so as we begin this second chapter, we're asking, how are these destitute widows, how are they going to fare? In particular, how is Ruth going to fare after this courageous faith, after pledging herself to the Lord? And that's where what we're going to see in chapter 2. And the first thing we see is that the Lord is at work. So let's pick up the story, chapter 2, verse 1. Now Naomi had a relative of her husband's, a worthy man of the clan of Elimelech, whose name was Boaz. And Ruth the Moabite said to Naomi, "Let me go to the field and glean among the ears of grain after him in whose sight I shall find favor." And Naomi said to Ruth, "Go, my daughter." So we learned in chapter 1 that Naomi is embittered, and so we're not surprised that she's feeling despondent, and she leaves it to Ruth to try and take the initiative to try and find some food to keep them alive. Now, the Lord had created a system. He taught his people that they were to build a system into their society where the poor could still with dignity provide for themselves. One verse which teaches this, Leviticus 23, "When you reap the harvest of your land," the Lord says, "do not reap to the very edges of your field, or gather the gleanings of your harvest, leave them for the poor and for the foreigner residing among you. I am the Lord your God. It's a lovely provision that the Lord makes. Israel were taught not to maximize profits in their business, but in their society, they were to create a system where the poor would benefit as part of their business model. And Ruth has clearly heard about this wonderful law that the Lord made, and she wants to see if life amongst God's people really is as compassionate and wonderful as she's heard. So what does she do? Verse 3, so she went out, she set out and went and gleaned in the field after the reapers. She happened to come to the part of the field belonging to Boaz, who was of the clan of Elimelech. Now, I mentioned before how we're only told that the Lord is directly responsible for two things in this whole book, providing the harvest in chapter 1 and then providing a baby in chapter 4. But I also mentioned last week that the Lord's fingerprints are practically everywhere in this book. And this is a great example of that. The text doesn't literally say kind of wink at this point, but it might as well do there in verse 3, because this language, she happened, wink, wink, to come to the part of the field belonging to Boaz. It's a little nudge, just by random chance, as if we lived in an impersonal, chaotic universe. She just happened to come into that field. And then it carries on in verse 4, and behold, Boaz came from Bethlehem. And the sense of that behold is, you know, and what do you know? Just look who turned up at that moment. What are the chances? Boaz came. This is the worthy man who is Naomi's relative and was introduced to us in verse 1. And it's crazy, isn't it, how random chances work in this world. That's what the writer's saying, but with their tongue in their cheek. Incidentally, as a youngster, I used to tie myself up in knots trying to work out whether something that had happened was just a happy coincidence, or even whether it was an answered prayer. And when these things happened, was it really from God or not? How do I know whether that might have happened anyway? Perhaps it was just chance. But the reality is that we don't live in a might have happened anyway kind of universe. There is no impersonal, chaotic universe. Such a universe has never existed and never will. The only universe that there is one that has been made by a personal and kind and sovereign God. And so there is no coincidence. If we have air in our lungs, if we have bread on our plates, if we have a job, if we have a family, any good thing that we have, it can only be a personal, generous gift from a sovereign God. And so every good thing we receive in this life is an opportunity for praise. Now, it's just possible, as I say this, that you may think that I am over-reading verses 3 and 4 here. In seeing the Lord's hand behind what is happening. But as we go on in the chapter, especially verse 20, Naomi puts this question beyond doubt, because she sees Ruth, and Ruth returns with this kind of sack full of grain on her back and a hamper full of leftovers from Boaz's field. And she says, let me put up the verse. Naomi says, may Boaz be blessed by the Lord whose kindness has not forsaken the living or the dead. Even Naomi, and we saw last week, Naomi is pretty slow to recognize the Lord's kindness in her life. Even Naomi, she can see here what is going on. The Lord is behind everything that's going on in chapter 2. So it is the Lord who is at work in all the kindnesses of this chapter. But what exactly is he doing? Well, let's keep going. Verse 4. And he and Boaz said to the reapers, the Lord be with you. And they answered, the Lord bless you. So here at last, after a lengthy introduction, Boaz steps onto the stage. And the first thing we're shown about him is that he is a God-saturated man. Someone whose business practice and his relationships, they're just shot through with an awareness of the Lord. Verse 5. Then Boaz said to his young man who was in charge of the reapers, whose young woman is this? And the servant who was in charge of the reapers answered, she's the young Moabite woman who came back with Naomi from the country of Moab. She said, please let me glean and gather among the sheaves after the reapers. So she came, and she's continued from early morning until now, except for a short rest. Now, there's numerous places in God's law where God's people are called to have a special care for the sojourner, the foreigner, the outsider. And they're to do that remembering that they themselves were once helpless nobodies, slaves back in Egypt. And Boaz here exemplifies the Lord's concern for the outsider here. He spots Ruth across the field, and he immediately takes an interest in her and in her welfare. And my father, who worked as a medic in hospital for most of his life, he told me that one of the best interview questions he'd found for assessing internal candidates in the hospital was to ask them what all the names were of the cleaners on their floor. And you get the sense from the way Boaz acts here that he would have aced that question. He's alert to all the people around him, whatever their situation. Let's keep going. Verse 8. Then Boaz said to Ruth, now listen, my daughter, do not go to glean in another field or leave this one, but keep close to my young women. Let your eyes be on the field that they are reaping and go after them. Have I not charged the young men not to touch you? And when you are thirsty, go to the vessels and drink what the young men have drawn. You see just a little hint here, don't you? I mentioned last week that the time of the judges was a very dark period in Israel's history. And we see here that the time of the judges, it wasn't a great place to be a foreign woman at that time, like Ruth. Even Boaz's own men need explicitly telling not to assault her. Imagine if that was your working environment. But of course, Boaz, he steps up and he acts for the Lord in this situation, and he provides the protection which Ruth needs. And he even makes sure that she can quench her thirst. Let's keep going. Verse 10. Then she, Ruth, fell on her face, bowing to the ground, and said to Boaz, why have I found favor in your eyes that you should take notice of me since I'm a foreigner? So the big issue, which has been repeatedly highlighted and foregrounded in this chapter, is Ruth's race, her Moabiteness. We saw it back in verse 2, Ruth the Moabite. That's how she's described. Or verse 6, she is the young Moabite woman. And then here again in verse 10, since I'm a foreigner. And it's not just that Ruth is an outsider generally. She's much worse than that in an Israelite mindset. She's a Moabite. And for an Israelite, Moab in particular has had a very dark history. Moab began under a dark cloud because the father of the nation, we learned back in Genesis 19, was himself the result of an incestuous union between Lot and his eldest daughter. And then when Israel first passed through Moabite territory, this was after escaping from Israel and they were on the way to the promised land, the Moabites refused to let them through and to offer bread and water to these refugees in Numbers 22. But instead, they actually hired Balaam to spout curses on Israel. It was a terrible moment in Moab's history. Then in Numbers 25, it was the daughters of Moab who were unleashed into the Israelite camp by Balaam to seduce Israelite men into sexual immorality and idolatry. And this immorality then provoked a plague from the Lord, which only stopped when Phinehas impaled a sexually immoral couple with his spear. And more recently in Judges 3, the Moabites under the generously sized King Eglon had attacked Israel. And they kept them subject, demanding constant tribute for 18 long years. So you can see that for an Israelite, hearing that there was a Moabite who had come to live next door was a bit like hearing that your child's new primary teacher had just returned from fighting for Islamic State in Syria. There was just this instinctive distrust and hostility for all kinds of historic reasons. And all this explains, doesn't it, Ruth's wonder at the way the Lord, through Boaz, has welcomed her in verse 10. I'll read again. Why have I found favor in your eyes that you should take notice of me, a foreigner? And I love that verse. It's a lovely verse because it resonates. It's the typical response of faith, isn't it? When we, as believers, when we start to grasp the gospel, when we glimpse what it is we deserve from the Lord, and we do, we deserve to be shut out. We deserve, as Neve was explaining, we deserve to be excluded from him, far from him, because of our past, because of the way we've treated God in all kinds of ways. And yet, what wonderful kindness, what a wonderful welcome we've been shown. As the hymn says, oh, who am I? Who am I that for my sake, my Lord should take frail flesh and die? Why me? Why should I be born into a Christian family if that's us? Or why should I have come under the sound of the gospel at that stage in my life? Why should I have had my eyes open to receive the truth? That's the tone of Ruth's questioning here, her wonderment. Why? Why have I found favour in your eyes that you should take notice of me, a foreigner? And next we get Boaz's answer to Ruth's question. Verse 11. But Boaz answered her, all that you have done for your mother-in-law since the death of your husband has been fully told to me, and how you left your father and mother and your native land and came to a people that you did not know before. And you can hear there echoes of what Abraham did when he left his father and his mother and his native land, and he came to a land that he did not know, right back in Genesis 12. And so Ruth, despite her Moabite ancestry, she is showing herself to be a true Israelite, a child of Abraham by faith. And then it goes on, verse 12, the Lord repay you for what you have done, and a full reward be given you by the Lord, the God of Israel, under whose wings you have come to take refuge. So I've been arguing so far in this chapter that it's the Lord who's the one who's giving this gracious welcome to Ruth as he takes Ruth under his wings. And here's another place where we see this clearly displayed. Yes, it's Boaz who's been the Lord's agent in extending the welcome to Ruth in line with the Lord's instructions and priorities in God's law. But when Boaz is asked why he's done it, he says it's because Ruth's actions are exactly the kind of actions that the Lord loves and that he loves to reward. And so Boaz clearly sees himself as being the Lord's representative in blessing Ruth. And he prays that the Lord would do it more and more. So the first and the main take home from this chapter, and this is why I've taken the bulk of our time, is to see and enjoy this wonderful picture of how the Lord welcomes the outsider who takes refuge under his wings. And as we see the Lord's welcome of Ruth, despite her having no reason to expect it and plenty of reasons to expect the opposite, I hope it helps us to wonder afresh at the Lord's incredible kindness and welcome to us in Christ, despite us having no reason to expect it either. Why have I found favour in your eyes that you should take notice of me? Or as we had in our theme verse, we were without hope and without God in the world. But now in Christ Jesus, we who were once far off have been brought near by the blood of Christ. Costly welcome. What kindness, what mercy we've been shown. So having established that it is the Lord who's giving this gracious welcoming in this chapter, I next want us to focus on the other perspective, which is how the Lord did it. And the answer is, and this is point two, he did it, he works through the kindness of his people. So of all the ways the Lord could have used to advance his purposes, drawing Ruth in, welcoming her into his people, and then through her, as we're going to see, bringing abundance and blessing and hope to Naomi, and ultimately bringing hope to the whole nation, as we're going to see in chapter four, it's very striking here and throughout this book that the Lord advances his purposes principally through the kindness of his people. And in this chapter, especially Boaz's kindness. Now, if you listen to a news station every day, or read the newspaper, you might get the impression that the most important things that happen in this world are politicians making statements or stock markets going up and down. I'm not saying that those things are unimportant, But on its own, the news does give us a very distorted picture, doesn't it, of what the really significant things are that happen each day in our world. There's a great quote in the Hobbit movie. Oh, I'm meant to leave 6 month gaps between these references, but here we go. But it's not directly from the book, which is my excuse, but it captures well the message of the book. And in the movie, Gandalf the Wizard says, and I've got a slide, "Some believe it is only great power that can hold evil in check. But that is not what I have found. I have found it is the small, everyday deeds of ordinary folk that keep the darkness at bay. Small acts of kindness and love." And I like that quote because I think it resonates so well with the Book of Ruth. The Book of Ruth is about ordinary people. There's no kings or priests or prophets. It's just ordinary people living in difficult times, but faithfully embodying God's law and God's priorities in just ordinary acts of kindness. And yet it's through these means that God then advances his great plan during these dark days of the judges, and through this ultimately bringing about the salvation of the world. Oh, I've just got a message saying that the slides, which are meant to be popping up on the screen, haven't done so, so I'm sorry about that. And I think this is a real encouragement for us here when we're asking that question we began with: does anything I do really matter? Because, of course, the answer is nothing we do in obedience to the Lord Jesus is ever wasted. Nothing is lost. And that's obviously true with our labour in the Lord, the labour of building God's church, which the Bible tells us is never in vain. But one of the wonderful things of and benefits of belonging to Jesus is that now everything we do in service of him, especially acts of kindness, is all received as worship to God, and all of it is therefore significant. One of the themes in Ruth, which we haven't yet had a lot of time to bring out, is the theme of how the Lord rewards his children. It's there in verse 12, and it's going to come up again. And Jesus teaches that even little acts of kindness, like he gives the example of inviting someone for a meal who can't invite you back in Luke 14, even these little acts will all specifically be rewarded, Jesus says, if not in this life, then at the final resurrection. Nothing we do in service of Jesus can be lost. Nothing will be wasted. It's all noticed, and it will all be significant. And what a wonderful blessing that is. What a difference it makes to know that as we go about our everyday lives. And this passage especially encourages us to show kindness to those who, like Ruth, are needy outsiders who are coming to take refuge under the Lord's wings. As Galatians 6 puts it, let us do good to everyone, and especially to those who are of the household of faith. And I love the way this already happens in so many ways here at Grace Church. You know, someone arrives in London not knowing anyone, and you know, they're offered hospitality in their first week here. Obviously a bit harder in lockdown. Someone else sees the financial challenges that many are facing due to the lockdown, and they ask whether they can contribute to a fund, as happened recently, to help those who need it. Someone else offers space to a lodger at a reduced or even at a zero rent. Someone else offers to spend their Saturday lugging boxes for someone who needs help moving house, and so on and so on. And it is wonderful. And between us, there's so many stories of ways this is already happening. And this chapter is an encouragement for us to do it more and more, because as the whole book shows us, the Lord is at work through the kindness of his people. And yet, as Ruth progresses, there is this realization that we need something more. And as I put on the sheets, or hope on the screens, right, apparently it's not working. And this is the final and briefest point. Ultimately, you and I need a redeemer. You see, Boaz does everything here that a faithful Israelite can be expected to do. In verse 14, he invites Ruth to share his food, and she eats until she's satisfied. In verses 15 to 16, he tells his men to deliberately leave sheaves on the ground for her to pick up, so that she ends up with, it says in verse 17, an ephah of barley. to take home to Naomi. Now, that doesn't have the impact with us because we don't know what an ephah is, but I looked it up. It's 22 litres, approximately 50 pounds in weight, or 22 kilograms, about as much as an adult can lift. So Boaz is embodying here just what the Lord calls his people to be. He's caring for the poor and needy. He's welcoming the excluded. Ruth left in the morning with nothing, didn't she? And she's returned to Naomi in the evening with more than they could ever have dreamed of. Not just with a takeaway tucked under her arm that they can eat there and then, the leftovers, but also with this huge mountain of grain to keep them going for the long haul. And yet still, the book could not end at Ruth 2, could it? A faithful Israelite is not enough. And let's pick up the story from verse 19. Let me read. And Ruth's mother-in-law said to her, "Where did you glean today? And where have you worked? Blessed be the man who took notice of you because of all this food." So she told her mother-in-law with whom she had worked and said, "The man's name with whom I work today is Boaz." And Naomi knows what we also know from verse 1. Boaz isn't just a great guy. He's not just a kind and godly man. He's also a relative of Naomi's dead husband, Elimelech. And Naomi knows exactly what this might mean. This means that there is just a chance that he might be the solution to all of their problems. And suddenly Naomi becomes much, much more interested in Boaz than she is in the food. Verse 20, and Naomi said to her daughter-in-law, "May he be blessed by the Lord, whose kindness has not forsaken the living or the dead." And I think that's a strange statement. It certainly would have sounded strange to Ruth. In what way is the Lord being kind to the dead by someone giving Ruth and Naomi food? How could Elimelech and Mahlon, who are the dead husbands, how could they possibly benefit from what's happening here? And so Naomi continues, verse 20. Naomi also said to her, "This man is a close relative of ours, one of our redeemers." Bum, bum, bum. Suddenly the whole story turns up a gear with that word redeemer. Boaz, he's not just a relative, he is a redeemer. And I've put there the Christ the Redeemer statue. In this context, a redeemer is one of a small number of men who have a recognized obligation under God's law to look after Elimelech's family. The Redeemer restores the freedom of those who have been sold into slavery in Leviticus 25. The Redeemer brings justice after a murder, Numbers 35. The Redeemer restores property that's had to be sold, Deuteronomy 25. Basically, the Lord has set up this incredible system so that if you have a problem and if no one else can help you and if you can find them, then a Redeemer will sort you out. They will put right whatever has gone wrong, and even restoring the name and the inheritance of those who have died, hence the reference. And so suddenly, with that word redeemer, we dare to hope that Boaz will be not just a kind guy, not just a godly benefactor, but perhaps he could be the one who will commit to Naomi and Ruth and who will take care of all of their needs. The one who will provide for and protect them, not just in this situation, but from now on. And of course, this is what you and I ultimately need as well. Being part of a community of faithful people, living out godly patterns of kindness and generosity is a wonderful thing. Church is brilliant when it's working and when there's real love and care. And we should be thankful for church. But it's not enough. Ultimately, each one of us needs a redeemer. We need one who will commit to us personally. We need one who is kind and strong enough to take on everything that's gone wrong and to put it right, not just today, but forever. And so if you're here, as many are, I guess, coming to church, enjoying and being part of things, but you haven't yet come to Christ, can I say you are missing out on the best bit by far? He is exactly what you need. Turn to him. Find in him everything you need. The one who will commit to you. The one who will provide for you, not just in this life, but forever. And for those of us who have found this gift, let's rejoice in it. What a great Redeemer we have.